Good afternoon, and welcome to another episode of We the People Radio. My name is Aaron Ryan.
And my name is Bill Cundiff.
Well, Bill, what do you have for us?
Well, Aaron, we have a sponsor this hour. It's Pape Machinery, our local John Deere ag and turf dealer. And right now you can go up there and get a great deal on a tractor or a mower or attachments, you name it. Go up and see them. They also have full parts and service. And they're located at 3119 Twin View Boulevard in the city of Shasta Lake. Or you can give them a call. Their phone number is 530-226-9226. Or catch them on the web at papemachinery.com.
Duh. Well, that's fun.
Yeah.
And, well, we survived all our episodes this week.
Well, we had the big Shasta County Fair.
Shasta District Fair.
Oh, Shasta District
Fair. Not to be confused with. So the Shasta District Fair, who could not accommodate a booth for the Catholics.
No, they were.
Though they had massive amounts of space in the building, they could not accommodate them, was what the letter said.
There were some empty spots.
Yeah, like about 12.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I wasn't going to say.
And then there was a pro-life display at the Republican Central Committee booth.
Yeah, they didn't like that either.
Borrowed from the Catholics since they were banned, and they came scurrying over and banned it in our booth too. So apparently, freedom of speech isn't a top priority there.
No.
But that fight has not ended. So if you live in Shasta County, just keep your ears peeled. We'll be moving forward with that because that's ridiculous. I figure the GOP booth will be banned next year. So they'll just ban us all
away.
They're
a bunch of radicals, those.
I went, okay, so spoiler alert. I went and talked to a bunch of other vendors, and they'd like to have babies at their booth. So I think babies are going to be popping up everywhere.
Yeah.
The stages of life babies, they're just rubber. They're little rubber babies. It shows how big babies are as they're growing. People really liked it. They were super interested. I had pregnant ladies come by showing their other kids how big the baby was. I don't know. Anyway, they said we had their language on the thing. They said we were displaying aborted fetuses. Like, no, that's a totally different thing. And it's icky and scary, and that wasn't happening. So anyway, I was going to do my free advertising of the week, but instead...
you ranted.
Instead, I went full Voldemort and did more bad news. Sorry, inside joke. So, Liam, how are we doing with Greg on the line? Is he on the line?
He's on the line.
Oh, he is. All right.
Good deal.
Well, so before I, you know, did the rundown, I thought I should double check he's in there. So Greg Allison was with us a couple of weeks ago, and we had such a good time. We were like, well, you got to come back. He'll have to come back a lot of times, actually. So didn't want to ruin that for you, but we'll do that more than once. And he is the Alabama State Director of the Task Force on National and Homeland Security. He's a subject matter expert in avionics system safety and has been active in the aerospace community as an electrical engineer, systems safety engineer, project program manager, team lead, and avid space activist for 45 years. So pretty much he's got 45 years experience more than I do.
Yeah.
He is. He designed the architectural layout of the power and data systems distribution for the International Space Station's nodes 2 and 3. He has designed power and control systems for industrial equipment and worked on the M1 Abrams tank and F-15 avionics. And for the past 20 years, he's been performing avionics system safety for NASA as a contractor employed by Bastion Technologies Incorporated, working on the Artemis 1 space launch systems, X-37, various satellites, and other projects. So the last time we talked to him, we spoke with him about balloons.
Yeah.
And we were chatting about the Chinese spy balloons and stuff, which led us into the electromagnetic pulse discussion and all of that good stuff. And, you know, Greg, it's really unfortunate that your specialty wasn't submarines. You could have probably helped those guys because... Oh wait, I forgot. You're not inspirational enough.
Oh, yeah, that's no problem.
Yeah, you're over the hill.
Yeah.
Too old.
Yeah.
Well, it just so happens I'm a safety engineer, and I would have had some things to say about that.
Yeah.
In the world of safety, you got to have a couple different things: design margin or safety factor, and margin of safety. You got to. That's where, you know, you have the point you designed to. This is how much meat you got to put in the system. How thick your hull's got to be so that it don't get crushed at a given pressure. So you design to that. Then you put a factor of safety on it for, you know, how much more you think you might need to be able to sustain. And so you make it a lot thicker. And hey, this is just part of it. And then you have, so you do that with systems where you can't have redundancy, like a pressure vessel, for example. You know, that's perfect. It's hard to have like two pressure vessels because you're inside one. So you might have two hulls, you know, but that's design margin also, factor of safety. If you had two hulls, both able to take the same pressure, it would be the same thing. But what they had there was one hull. And they already had people in the house. David Lockridge, you know, he and another guy raised issues about this, you know. And what happened? They got fired.
Oh, you're kidding.
No, and one of them even got sued. I think because he probably said something about the hull thickness. He's accused of being putting out proprietary data or something like that. It's insane. You know, that guy also said, you know, basically the owner of the company was saying, safety don't matter. CEO, what's his name? Stockton, I forget it off the top of my head. But anyway, he was saying, safety don't matter. Safety is blah, blah, blah. But he was very dismissive of safety. And you can see he paid for it with his life, but he also took a lot of other lives with him, including a 19-year-old who was really scared to go down. I don't feel missing too much, but it's germane to everything because, you know, safety factors into everything, really. It should be a part of all of our considerations of life, especially if you're doing something uber risky, like going down way below the crush depths that our nuclear submarines can go. This is way below there. They could not go down there. They would be imploded definitely. So you have to build a super strong structure. And another thing in safety is you need redundancy on critical systems. You got to remember what systems are critical for your operation for you to stay alive. And propulsion is probably one of them. like your, you know, status navigation control and rockets, I'm assuming about the same way in the submarine. So there's certain things that are critical systems that you need to have redundancy in, preferably dissimilar redundancy in case you bought the same circuit component, you put it in each of your redundant strings and it goes bad in both, you know, or you do a critical point failure analysis to make sure there's not one thing that can bring down both strings. So there's a lot of little analysis to do, but the importance of that is that if one string fails, you got a backup. Well, maybe you want more than one backup, depending on how long your mission is, how critical it is, how risky. You might want to have a number of different strings. A launch vehicle that we do typically has just one string because the mission's 8 minutes. If you're up in the space station where you're going to be for umpteen months and a long time to rescue, like going down the bottom of the sea, you really want to have about three totally complete operational strings on your redundancy. That's what they should have had, and I don't know they had any at all, other than they did have multiple ways supposedly to float the thing, but if you crush, it don't matter, you're not floating. What happens,
right.
Another thing to consider is composite materials. Composite materials aren't like metals. We're all used to metals. Composite materials are made out of fibers. Those fibers can break individually. And without extensive NDE, non-destructive testing, and I don't know if you could do it on a hull that thick, you don't know if those fibers are broken. Another thing, between the layers, you can get delamination. You don't even know if when you made it, there might, unless you did an extensive NDE on after you manufactured, were there any air pockets in it? And that's a tough thing in manufacturing composites. See, I deal with that. I've dealt with that because we had to do composites in the rockets that I built and flew from balloons. And also as part of the previous program I worked on, when I worked on the solid rocket booster, it had composites inside, you know, we had to put stuff inside of the booster casings so that they wouldn't overheat the shell itself. And then we had the nozzles, which were laid up phenolic composites, and they had to be able to ablate the big nozzles on the rocket boosters. And so, you know, I'm familiar with these kind of things. I know you can get delamination, especially if you got an air bubble in. But see, every time you put this thing under pressure and release the pressure on it, it's going to push in. It's going to give out. That means the layers between them can delaminate over time. Now, reports in the past was that when they went down, they heard loud popping. That was probably either fibers breaking or it could have been delaminating when all that was going on. And it might be, I was told they had sensors. I don't know how you would have looked at that with sensors other than sound. They probably missed it. And so, and every time you stress something like that, you got to where you've made new cracks, made new Metal will crack too, but metal is malleable.
Oh.
It's more forgivable. That's why, you know, you take metal and bend it, you know, and it won't necessarily break. If you bend it enough, it'll break. But you can, but composites are not malleable. They're stronger on a per weight basis, but their strength is like, they might be 10 times stronger on one axis than another. There's a lot of design factors when you use composites, and I would not want to go in submarine made of composites. That is, to me, was to have what to went down to that depth. There may be something running around shallow in the sea, might not be a problem. Going down to such crazy crush depths, I think the whole proposition was insane. And the guy who did it, problem is, here's the problem. We engineers are guilty of one thing. When we design something, it's our baby.
Oh,
it can't
go
wrong because I've looked at everything. I know it can't be bad. It's like Bert Rutan when he did, running the scale composites, this Spaceship One. Look, I got two holes. I've done all this stuff for safety. I'm great. This is the safest thing in the world. Nobody's going to get hurt. And that thing has yet to fly a paying tourist, and it already killed four people. And one of them was one of my friends that got used to work for me, died in a cold flow test because of probably a static buildup charge flowing through composites. So composites bring in a whole new wrinkle, a lot of stuff into your design. And it could just mean the nitrous went into critical overpressure, too. Actually, I got a report on that saying that that could happen. And then we're out in the desert, Mojave Desert, where everything was dry. And, you know, it shouldn't have been in the airport. It was crazy there. But see, people just think, my stuff isn't going to go bad, but it can. And that's one of our problems we think about with our defense. Oh, we got all these defenses, we're good. But you're not looking at where the enemy is looking at how to slip through the cracks. What is it you're not looking for? What is it your defense assets have not arrayed themselves for? And I say this is a segue into the balloon topic. What we talked about last time, well, so I made the following statement, basically. I said that from a balloon launch just outside of our air defensive identification zone, 400 miles out to sea, somebody launching a balloon off a ship could have a EMP device, electromagnetic pulse, and detonate it at an altitude of 120,000 feet. And even if that balloon just went straight up, it was 400 miles offshore, it would still penetrate 88 miles inland and take out everything. Now, chances are, if it's on the side where the breeze is blowing, you get breeze, you get stratospheric winds, it can be up to 200 miles an hour at 120,000 feet. You're probably going to be well inland. But once you get above 80,000 feet, we don't have any fighters that can shoot missiles to hit you or nothing else. Because, you know, we got the operational range, most of our jet fighters is, 60, 65,000 feet. And the AIM-9, which they shot at the other part of balloons. By the way, those jets, that spy balloon was at a lower altitude because you don't have much winds at 56,000 foot altitude. So it was at the slower wind altitude so that it could loiter and spend more time spying on us.
Oh.
That's what they want to fight. That same balloon is capable of going to 30 kilometers, which would have a reach of 420. But I would be more worried about a different kind of balloon, a zero pressure balloon that is cheaper, goes higher, carries more payload, and is going to be harder to hit. And it's easy to launch off of a ship. I've launched balloons off of ships with rockets attached to them. Now, if you attach a rocket to it, you get more cross range. You can take that payload, that EMP device, further inland. Or if you launch it off one of the coasts where the stratospheric winds are blowing against you, you can overcome that and still get way inland with a rocket assist. The kind of rockets I was doing 25 years ago.
Wow.
So the point of this is this. The bottom line is, we don't have a weapon system today. Laser beams are spread too far. Everybody, little lasers, they cut a boom down. No, at that length, you get too much beam spread coming through the atmosphere. The AIM-9s may have a published range of 20 miles, but that's straight up. The motors on them, depending on the variant of the motor, of the AIM-9, which has the Sidewinder missile that we shot those other party balloons down with. One of them was party balloon. $200 party balloon with over $450,000 missile. But anyway, and one of them, they shot two of them.
But who's counting?
Shot two. So, they had $1 million shoot down. That one was probably a Chinese lantern from where I heard it described. But I know whose balloon one of them belonged to. I actually know it belonged to Northern Illinois Bottle Cap Balloon Flight Association. Yeah.
Oh,
friends of one of my best friends. So,
is that for advertising? We are so threatening to the competition. The government shot our balloon down.
Yeah.
It took $1 million to bring our balloon down.
Yeah.
We are so great. You know, they should be able to parlay that into some money. Greg, we have to take a really quick break. We'll be right back.
Okay.
It is kind of funny, though, $1 million to bring down a party balloon. Oh, my gosh. You're listening to We the People. Let me know you're here, because my TV set just keeps it.
This is Officer Joe with your marijuana safety message. Is your marijuana killing you? A testing of 1,000 NorCal dispensary samples found the majority had toxic mold or substances harmful to humans. As a bud tender, recommended THC products for treatment of medical conditions while you get sicker or exacerbate mental health issues. Get professional medical help and sue the dispensaries for the product and advice liability. Marijuana is not medicine for most Americans, and there's no medicine that is smoked. Remember, let's be careful out there.
Engineer song. Don't do your safety checks. It'll be heaven that finds out about it. So, Greg, with some of these balloons that they're like flying in weapons and things like that on, do we like at what point can we see them? Can we see all these things on whatever it is we track this stuff with? Or, I mean, why do they use balloons? Because they're less expensive?
Well, there's several good reasons for this. One, a balloon is cheaper than a rocket.
Okay.
Much cheaper. A little AIM-9, was almost $500,000. A balloon, that can lift a good-sized rocket. Like I used to buy all those things for $10,000. Some of them more than that. Helium's going to cost for hydrogen. But still, compared to a missile, it's far cheaper.
Yeah.
Far cheaper. And
can you control where the balloon goes, though? We've all let balloons go, and off they. I mean, who knows where they go?
Okay, let me tell you how I used to do it.
Okay.
I used to decide I was going to launch a rocket at a specific point in the sky from a balloon. I could put that balloon right at that very point in the sky.
Really?
All I had to do was launch from sea. I'd do this over the ocean. And I would figure out what time I wanted that balloon to launch, what the winds aloft were, so that I knew if I wanted that balloon in the sky at that point, knowing how that balloon would ascend through the wind profile, I would have to be able to launch that balloon from a certain point at sea. Then I figured out how long it was going to take me to inflate that balloon and which way the wind was blowing. So I would back off from the balloon launch point to a destination in the sea that was upwind, and then I would run with the wind for the balloon inflation time. By the time I got to that point, I wanted to release the balloon would be ready to go. I would release it, follow the winds, and would go to that point in the sky pretty close. It would be within a small margin of error. So, yeah, it's from launching the sea, you actually have a lot of control.
Okay.
So if your objective is that you launch a balloon from a point where it will be carried downwind, you can actually pretty much get it where you want to. I used to tease one of my buddies. He used to would launch one of these balloons, and he would have it land close to his girlfriend's house in Dalton, Georgia. I'm in Alabama, and he'd go out and grab the balloon and go on a date.
See, like balloon for most of us just seems really random.
They're at the mercy of the wind.
Off they go. It's like, oh well.
people aren't expecting what can be done with balloons. That's why this makes a perfect attack platform. You want to attack somebody with something they're not expecting. And we haven't anticipated this. That's why I'm ringing the bell on it, because China's got a huge balloon force. You got a bunch of engineers over there. They figured this out. Because if one little redneck rocket scientist like me can figure it out, I know that with all the engineers I get, somebody over there can think it up, you know, especially when it's out in open literature. So I'm just trying to explain to people on our side. It's quite obvious by the fact that we shoot down party balloons with AIM-9 missiles that our guys don't know what the heck they're doing.
Well,
so that's the proof in the pudding.
Kind of terrifying.
You know, I wrote the white paper for the EMP Task Force on National Homeland Security. And one of the things I put in there was guidelines like, you know, size ranges. If the balloon's underneath these size ranges at altitudes, there's no point in going after it. Like at the spy balloon altitude, it should be as big at least as a bus to be a target. At twice that altitude, it ought to be as long as two buses. Actually, I use for a bus 40 feet, so 40 to 80 feet should be a size range criteria. Now, here's what I would do. I'll be watching for that guy at sea to launch. And when I see a boat running, boats usually going from point A to point B, the shortest distance. They're not trying to chase the wind. If I watch a boat going in a straight line chasing the wind, going exactly the same speed and direction as the wind, something's up. That's not normal. Even if you go in the wind, go the same speed, same direction. Boats just don't do that. Not usually. I would say, I would put some drones up to look for that. In fact, I would use, Predator drone maybe to shoot them down, because these things are going to be at such an altitude that you don't want. Well, if it's got a nuke on it from the MP, you don't be anywhere close to it. So, a General Atomics MQ-9 Reaper Predator B drone would have a could carry quite a payload package of missiles to go after it. And if you had to, you'd ram it into it itself. But there's other drones, too. Right now, the one that's been used a lot for reconnaissance at altitude, they're flying right now over the Black Sea to keep an eye on what's going on in Ukraine, is the Northrop Grumman RQ-4 Global Hawk.
The RQ-4 what?
Global Hawk.
Oh, Global Hawk.
RQ-4
okay.
Global Hawk. There's a new one coming out that's going to be that will outperform it. It's the Northrop Grumman MQ-4C Triton. Now, those aren't missile platforms. Those fly higher. They go about 65,000 feet, so they can be on the lookout for the targets. The Predator drone can also look out, but it can also go in and attack them. But the key to this whole thing is you want to get them before they're high enough to cause a problem. So let me explain the problem. You asked this question earlier, and I kind of didn't get to it.
That never happens to me, by the way.
Oh, okay. Let's say you are in San Diego. You're at a Navy base in San Diego, and you got a big array of radars there at the Navy base, and you're looking out over the ocean to see if the Chinese are coming over the border with one of their bombers or coming over the horizon. Most of those radars are really only good for 250 miles. You're probably 400 miles out. But let's just say you've got a super-duper radar that can see things really well 400 miles out.
Okay.
It's going to be hard to see one of these balloons, by the way, if they don't put metal on it, which they could absolutely do. And they could put radar absorbing stuff on. I covered all that in my paper. They can make it extremely hard to see. But let's say you had the ability to see it instantaneously when it pops up over the horizon, and you're smart enough to not stand around with your thumb in your ear, and say, what is this? What is this? What do we do? What do we do? Let's say you automatically call your fighter squadron and send them out. It's already too late, because that balloon, as soon as it pops over the horizon from 400 miles out, is going to be at 80,000 feet due to the curvature of the Earth flat earthers.
Mm-hmm.
I got a lot of friends who are flat earthers. They don't believe in that. But no, if you've flown balloons and done art radio stuff and work with aircraft, balloons, you know the Earth's got a curvature. Rockets, you know the Earth's got a curvature. But anyway, so I hate to disappoint people.
Do they really think that? I mean, do people that...
Oh, God, I run into people all the time that think that. You wouldn't believe how many people think that now. It's spreading. It's spreading like the
flat Earth thing?
Don't add the barbarian.
What's the advantage? I mean, like, why spend time on the flat Earth? I mean, like, what do they think is they're gaining by that?
Oh, They believe in the flat earth just because they take some literal, I think, misinterpretation of the Bible, you know. But that, I don't want to go all into that. You know, I believe.
Oh, okay, so it's not a science thing, obviously.
Yeah, no scientists believe it. There's no scientists, no real airmen. I mean,
oh, okay, I feel better now. I was like, oh no, what? Scientists believe it?
No.
Well, they think there's global warming, so I don't, you know.
Let me be clear, the earth is a sphere. Global warming, that's a whole other thing.
It's a whole other problem.
Well, I know John Christie and Dr. Roy Spitzer, and they run the UAH satellite temperature data. And they'll tell you that a lot of stuff we're hearing is misinterpretation.
Yeah, I think.
So, you know,
yeah.
but everybody tells us, oh, so the science is clear. All the scientists agree, and if they don't agree, they work for the oil industry. No, and heck no. I know scientists ain't got nothing to do with oil industry. They're the ones that collect the data, and they don't agree with it. In fact, I know three climatologists. That's all I know. All three of them don't agree with it. So it's like, okay.
You're betting 1,000.
Experts in the field, PhDs, that get to look at the data all the time. They don't buy that, but that's another story.
Yeah, sorry. Didn't mean to rabbit trail you, but that's to me, that's almost as, you know, when you, we learned as kids, there was no end point to science. Science always had ... at the, you know.
Bingo. Science is always open.
If it isn't, you're not doing science.
You come up with a hypothesis, and the hypothesis is a wild-ass guess, It's an informed decision based on some data. It looks like this is the case. Okay, given that, let's prove it. Then you have to come up with a test, and you have to have a control group, and you vary one thing to see if you can make a proof. And then once you've done several tests and proofs and it's independently verified, then you can develop a theory. A theory isn't a wild idea. A lot of people just say, well, my theory is, you don't have a theory. That's just your wild idea. It's not a theory. You know, a theory, and scientifically speaking, now, you know, what layman's parlance, you can call it anything you want to. I believe in freedom of speech, but.
But that doesn't make you correct or, yeah.
Okay, it should be that you form a hypothesis, then you test. It's got to have independent verification. But if anything shoots this so-called theory down, thing, it should be out. But the problem in the world of science, and one reason I don't like this, the science is settled, is I've worked in engineering organizations all my life and other organizations, science organizations, and I know once an engineer or a scientist writes something down, it usually has to go through the management cycle before it gets released to public. And what the engineer or scientist writes based on the data and the engineering they got and what gets out to the public, quite often seldom resembles each other. And when you're in organizations that get your money from promoting a particular political viewpoint, guess what?
Yeah. Suddenly, all roads lead to Rome, right?
Yeah, money muddies everything.
Yeah.
A new quote. Money muddies everything. I just coined that one. That's a good one. So,
and you heard it here first.
There you go. We got a new quote. Everybody use it. Might give me credit on it.
Give us a little hashtag on it so we can be popular.
Anyway. All right, so we coined a new term, the phrase of the call tonight. Maybe we'll change society. At least give everybody a little perspective on that. You got to be able to see through the chaff and all this stuff. You know, I don't hear anybody tell me. I've had kids try to lecture me on this topic. Well, the science is clear. Blah, 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 blah.
Did that work out kind of like what they did with Dianne Feinstein?
Well,
she let him have it.
Oh.
That was like the only, that's the only funny thing I could think of with her was when those little kids came into her office and tried to tell her something about science and she just like let them have it and it all YouTube. Like, Dianne Feinstein was mean to little kids. Like a brother.
Well, you know what that's good for them, actually. We coddle the kids too much. You know,
you can't tell them they're right when they're not. I mean,
one of the things I do is gardening.
And
I know you start plants a lot of times in a greenhouse and get early started on them, but you can't just take a plant from a greenhouse and stick it out in the field or a garden. It'll die. You got to harden it off. You got to slowly introduce it to an interim environment where it gets a little rain, a little more sunlight, more wind exposure to the environment. I put them like under a shade tree on a platform before I put them out in the garden or field, you know, in terms of plants. And it's called harden them off. Kids may do the same thing. You know, they got to have some stress. They got to be used to what the real world's like, or they can't handle it.
Yeah.
So that's actually that can be
hence
a good thing.
Hence the invention of the safe space.
I've been in the military. Drill sergeant should yell at you, make you do push-ups. They should cuss you out and maybe even hit you a time or two. I mean, now that's the offer of boat and all that. You know, how are you going to handle combat when you face an enemy that's going to do far worse to you?
Yeah.
I mean, you know, and are you going to give up all the secrets of all your comrades, you know, and all your buddies, your squad members, just because somebody frowned at you? I don't know. Boy, what's going to break you? You shouldn't be easy to break. You should be tough. You need to be hardened by off. That's just part of the process. But anyway, that's another story. So back on this balloon thing. Once you're at 80,000 feet, you're already over the altitude that they can take it down. So if they had a transporter, if they had their jet sitting there, ready to go, and the pilot sitting in it, ready to go, everything's loaded up, and he was in a Star Trek transporter that could put him immediately at his operational flight altitude, right below that balloon, which we know it's not the case, it'd be out of range.
Uh-huh.
If he had a 20-millimeter cannon, at best, they might get another 10,000 feet up above, but, you know, this balloon's at 80,000 feet already. If he had an AIM-9 missile, they tell us it will go 20 miles, but the motor on it's only, depending on the variant, only burns for like 5.4 seconds to 6 seconds. Going straight up, it'll only get about 10,000 feet. And then you just don't have the mass fraction. You need to get the altitude mass fraction. Rocket parlance is the ratio of fuel to the ratio of the total mass of the system. So the higher that number is, the higher it's going to fly. Providing, you know, of course, for a rocket to fly, thrust has to exceed weight. That's the other thing. But the situation is that they're not going to get to those altitudes of those missiles. And if they were sitting right under, but they won't be. By the time they get out there, it'll be at 100,000 feet, maybe 120 already. And the sad thing is, if they could take it down, it'd probably take them out too if it's got a nuke on board. We've got to have other means to stop this. Now, what I would say is it's all reliant on immediate detection. That's why I say I think you might want to put a Northrop Grumman MQ-4C out there, the Triton, or a Northrop Grumman RQ-4 Global Hawk. I think we ought to come up with other platforms eventually that fly higher and are cheaper and longer-range flights, like the Zephyr drone or something like that down the road. We need to come up with other stuff that will do the looking. But you need something to carry missiles or some way to deal with it, and it needs to be a drone. And the best one out there that's currently available is the General Atomics MQ-9 Reaper, which is also known as a Predator drone, or Predator B. There's different Predator drones. Predator B would be the best one because it can carry a lot of missiles. It's also got a side aperture looking radar, and it's got a camera on board. And some guy can be sitting at the console back at the base doing all the stuff. You know, and they don't have to be there on site in case this thing goes boom. The reason I worry about going boom is because, you know, a lot of people say, well, just EMP it. Well, what I fear is they will make these things where the whole thing is reliant on a wind-up timer to release the payload, which would be the EMP device. And as soon as it gets an acceleration on it, it'd be an accelerometer trigger.
Oh. So it starts falling.
It goes boom. So once you shoot it down, it just decimates.
Sure.
So that's how they could come up with a way to get around. Oh, we shot the balloon. It's coming down. It's great. Well, no, because it's already close and inland. It's too close. You're already going to get everything fried. So even if you successfully shoot the balloon down, it still has a successful mission because it goes boom and takes out everything for miles and miles and miles inland. Maybe it's close enough that it'll take 300 miles of stuff out inland. And everything on our shore, I mean, we got most of our military bases, most of our cities, most of our industry, our trade, our ports, airports, all kind of stuff out on the shore.
If
somebody had a couple of these ships on the East Coast, a couple off the West Coast, and a couple in the Gulf of Mexico, that could devastate the entire United States, especially if a few of them carry rockets, the ones that's, you know, not down, you know, upwind from their targets, because they're upwind the targets, which is naturally going to drift over the target. So that's the way they could totally obliterate the United States with the MP tax on a balloon. And you probably would never see it in the first place.
Well,
watch it.
We have to take a really quick break, but when we come back, I'm kind of curious, like, what, how do they, I know this isn't what they do, but, you know, I'm not a balloon expert, right? So how do they drive the balloon around? Like, how do they make it go where they want to go? Maybe when we come back, you could give us a clue on that, because honestly, balloons seem so random, and you're telling us how accurate they can be. I'm really curious how you control where they go and how they get there, because we've all seen those things, like, where people go on a balloon ride, and they wind up somewhere, you know? It's like, oops, we didn't plan on that. Drop the sandbag, and whoosh, off they go. So our guest today is Greg Allison. You're listening to We the People, and you can find us at wethepeopleradio.us.
Would you like to ride in my beautiful balloon? Would you like to ride in my beautiful balloon? We could float among the stars together, you and I. For we can fly. Up and away.
This is Officer Joe with your marijuana safety message. Did you know that the marketing of marijuana is a misogynistic and racist activity? That's right. Most marijuana corporations are owned and controlled by rich, fat cat white corporate types, and most dispensaries are placed into depressed communities of color. These communities can least afford the chains of drug addiction and corporate greed. For more information about marijuana, please visit sources like ALM, Americans Against Legalizing Marijuana, at www.aalm.info. And remember, let's be careful out there.
The world's spinning round like a loony balloon, heading for a collision with Saturn and Mars. And we're narrowly missing the man in the moon, spinning out of control, crashing into the stars. Have we all lost our gravity, reason and sanity? Is this the price that we pay? Have we all lost our way on this loony balloon?
That would be like the Flat Earth Guys song you could play for them. They might like that. I think the Kinks might have been ahead of their time. So how do they make the balloon go where they want it to go?
There's three things to bear in mind here. Most of the balloon's going to follow the wind. Now, we've got good atmospheric models out there. You know where the wind's blowing. And you can even send up a trial balloon.
Yeah.
little weather balloon.
The proverbial trial balloon?
Yeah, a literal, real, honest-to-God trial balloon. So this is one of the things you can do. So if you do like I did, and let's say you want to target a specific place that you want this balloon to detonate, and let's say if I want the center of this detonation just, 300 miles offshore of North Carolina, California, 250, 300 miles. I can start out, like I get further inland than that. I can depend on the winds aloft. I could start out 400 miles outside the ADIZ, that's the Air Defense Identification Zone. I could, pick my point for the release of the balloon. And of course, I could back figure, how long it's going to take me to inflate it, and where the winds are on, the surface winds are blowing. And I could start my boat up from that spot and be ready to release it when I get to the spot that the winds need to pick it up from. And then it would float upwards, and then I know what the winds aloft are, so I know where that point in the sky would be, a point chosen, so that the airstream would take it over the intended target. So if I wanted, I could do this. If I wanted to target San Jose, San Francisco area, that's kind of, in the middle of the state of of California. I could take out everything from San Diego. I could take out every major city in California, every major military base, and every major city from this one EMP device.
What the hell? So is the balloon the size of a minivan, the size of a skyscraper, the size of a lunchbox? Like, how big a balloon is this?
This balloon would probably be about 80 feet, 80 to 100 feet, by the time it gets altitude. A lot of times it gets up to 120,000 feet, maybe, a little over 100 feet, 100, 120, something like that. But it would be small when it starts out, because at 100,000 feet, the atmosphere is only 1% as thick as it is on Earth. You know, for all intents and purposes, we'd call that a vacuum, which happens to be the same as on the surface of Mars. You fly a helicopter on Mars, just blows my mind.
Yeah.
But they do it. That's an engineering marvel. That Martian helicopter thing. So That means if the atmosphere is 1% acidic with zero pressure balloon, like I'm talking about using here, it would have to expand 100-fold the time it reached that altitude. Now, the other kind of balloon, what we saw, the Chinese spy balloon, was a super pressure balloon. It keeps the same outer envelope, but it's got an inner envelope that expands as it goes up inside the outer envelope. It's called a ballonet. That's where the lift gas is. And they can have atmospheric gas in that outer envelope if they want. They can pump in and out as a form of ballast, actually. They can set those balloons, depending on how much air they put in that inner envelope and how much payload they put on, how much lift gas they put in. They can set it to go whatever altitude they want to fly it at. So for the loiter balloons, they flew those in the 60,000-foot range because there was almost no wind. There was very little wind. So they got a lot of loiter time going over the targets that they could spy on. But now, what I'm saying is, I could pick a point, float this thing over, and it would detonate and take out everything that I wanted to take out easily without any further control. But now, how do you get control if you want other control? Well, there's a couple ways to do that. So what I meant, first point was pick your launch point and know the wind's aloft. The second thing is to catch the winds that go in the direction you want them. One is what normal ballooners do, which means that you can carry extra ballast up and then drop off ballast to go to a higher altitude and get winds aloft that are higher going in the direction you want to go because different winds go in different directions. Or you could vent a little lift gas and drop back down to catch a lower wind. If you got like a hot air balloon, like people ride on, you can control that by how much flame you throw up into the envelope of the balloon, with your gas burners. But and we're not talking a gas burner hot air balloon here. We're talking about something that's way higher, way, way higher. And so the lift gas is going to be helium, which is expensive now, or hydrogen. Hydrogen is typically explosive, but it's a lot better lift gas. And now it's cheaper. And really, you shouldn't have any problem with it, if you're launching from the deck of a boat, as long as, nobody's smoking right next to it. Let's get altitude.
So the balloon is still its forward motion is always controlled by the wind. Do you have the ability to turn it?
Well, yeah. Let me go into that. So in general, a balloon follows the wind. But picking the right winds and or using ballast, you can control which wind you catch. All right. So I mentioned two ways to control it. One is pick your launch points and know the winds aloft to get it where you want to. Two is by controlling the ballast and lift gas. Three, all right, now we're going to look at another thing. The Chinese spy balloon had onboard propulsion. And it takes some pretty good propulsion to overcome the winds to any degree. Now, at the loiter altitude, that's easier to do because the winds are lower. So it had propulsion. It had these huge solar arrays on it, so it probably had most likely propellers of some kind or array of propellers. That's what I think it probably had. Another way this might be through electrostatic ion wind generators, something that a lot of people in the UFO community like call lifters. They're really just something that accelerates ionic air. I've played around with these. They move a lot of air. In fact, some of your air filter devices use that as a method to suck air through and blow it out. There's no moving parts. You might have seen them. I think it was maybe the Dyson fan has one of those in it. I don't know. But anyway, and there's an aircraft that somebody's just recently invented, a little drone aircraft that are flying around with this kind of technology. So that might be another way. Have some onboard propulsion, but that works best where the winds are lower. Although it could work otherwise, but not as much. Now, if you had like a dirigible or an airship with some serious motors on it and you got a pointy nose and it's long cigar shaped, then your wind profile is a lot less for your wind gas, and it's easier to steer around. Now, also, you can control the payload package by having a payload package that can steer. And to do that, you can have a cold gas reaction control system. They're just little thrusters that just blow air through it, basically. We use pressurized gas on one that we put up with what we call the balloon launch return vehicle. We built a lift body that was remote controlled and rocket launched and put a boat on balloon. I did this for $70,000 back in 1928, 25 years ago. Yeah, so this is one, and because it had a pilotable, remote pilotable lift body on it, we could have steered this thing and got a lot of cross range and flew it to where we wanted to go. If it had a nuke on it, see, we could have flown it right over any kind of weapon system. We could have flown it right over the target, even if we had to go against the winds. So if I was on the, say, the winds at balloon altitudes, yeah, once you get up, you know, over 80,000, 100,000 feet, they have a particular direction. Most of the year they blow from the west to the east. And a little bit more stable than the jet streams that the aircraft fly in. And a little faster. And but there's two times a year that wind stops. And it's called spring and fall turnaround. So it's just like almost dead quiet up there. You can float a balloon straight up and it'll just hover in one spot, which would be great for an MP platform. Be great for attacking from both all coasts because your balloons will stay in the one spot. And you can have all coastal systems attack without any other assist mechanism needed. Now, if you wanted to fly a balloon, say, from the east coast when the wind is blowing from the west, then you'd put a rocket assist device on there or something like I flew, maybe a drop vehicle that has a glide profile. Like the hypersonic glide vehicles, which Chinese have already tested dropping those in balloons, so that's kind of weird. They're already looking at weapon systems and balloons. They've done drone drops. They've done these hypersonic-type-looking vehicle drops. They're definitely and they set the design point on that spy balloon to be able to take 1.1 tons up to 30 kilometers, which is about 90,000 feet. So they've already experimented with developing the systems for delivering EMPs. And that, the fact they picked that altitude, because that's pretty much an optimum altitude for an EMP to cover. If you get below that, there's some people that say that the EMP won't be as effective once you get below 30 kilometers. But I know some physicists who say that's not true. But that's what's in some of the literature. So they set the design point that balloon go 30 kilometers screams EMP to me. So they but we, the one we saw wasn't at 30. But that one balloon type is actually designed to be able to reach 30 kilometers. So yeah, what was it going with steering the balloons? Okay, so now we've covered three methods. So we're picking a launch point, ballast. And also, we've covered the propulsion. We're really four, because then we've talked about having a package you can steer around. So if you get a rocket, you give it a kind of an assist by pointing along the way of the vector you want to fire it. And, you know, just that rocket assist. Now, what I was saying is the winds blow from west to east, and you got this turnaround in spring and fall. Well, in the summertime, the winds go from east to west, the turnaround.
Oh.
The turnaround is the time when the upper atmosphere at the balloon altitude, 80,000 feet above, are getting ready to blow the other way.
It's so funny, you know, and for the rest of us, we all think this is just so random.
No, it's not so
apparently
random.
Apparently it's not so random.
If you know what the winds aloft are, and if you can control your launch point on the surface of the Earth, which you can absolutely do with a ship, then you can put that balloon where you want it, when you want it there. And that's really all it takes for an EMP attack, just knowing where you want that balloon to be. And that's why I don't think we'd see this Chinese spy balloon. I think we'd see a zero-pressure balloon. They're cheaper, they fly higher, they're easier to inflate off boats. I've done it. You can do the super-pressure balloons off boats. But the only reason to do those is because they can stay aloft for months. So if you want something to go all the way from China to the United States, that's what you would use. If you want to be able to fly from, if you're just going offshore, and your mission time's only going to be at most 3 hours. So given that, you see, you could absolutely do the launch, and the whole mission time is short. So the zero pressure balloon is all you need. And it gives you better performance, lower cost. That's exactly what I would expect them to launch if they were going to attack us. But the good thing about that is, if you got those drones up looking, if they got some AI software on them, and they see boats out there going in the same direction and speed as the wind, for say, several minutes, you got an alarm right there. And so we should be able to detect them. But the key thing is, we got to have the right assets in the air at the right time, looking and knowing what they're looking for. And we got to have some means to take it down before it gets high enough to do any damage. And so that's why the Predator drone would be perfect, even though it only has an operational ceiling of 50,000 feet. If you let it get over 50,000 feet, you're going to get in the trouble zone already. So you need to be able to catch it from the get-go.
Yeah, because if it's up that high, it's over your, it's closer to the target, and then you run the risk of wrecking everything on the ground.
Right. Now, if there's a Chinese spy balloon coming from China that they've set at the operational altitude of 30 kilometers, you're going to have a hard time hitting it with anything, but you're going to know it's coming for a long time if you've got, you know, assets in the ocean monitoring for it, which you should have. I don't want to say we will, but we should. We need
how,
to make
how do you how do you think it. The Chinese got that balloon clear over the United States undetected?
Well, we detected it. Apparently, they claim the United States knew it was there when it got over Alaska, and some people said they saw it over the Pacific, Hawaii, but it went up over Alaska and drifted down. We weren't announcing. Somebody in Montana started taking pictures about it and yelling about it and publishing it. And look, we got, what is this thing?
Wow.
Then they couldn't deny it. They might have just let it flown over if nobody, and people would have seen it when it got more populous areas. But they might not have had a clue. Probably would have generated some UFO reports. I've done that with a few of my balloon plots. So, especially when it came down a lady's backyard, we had an oxidizer tank we were flying to test. Could we keep the pressure 750 PSI so we'd have enough pressure for our nitrous oxide in our rocket motor? And we had a big pink package on a big silver balloon. It had a big beeper on it to make it easier to look at. So it was going beep, 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 beep. And then coming down this woman's yard again in northwest Georgia. And she called up the local sheriff. She said, there's a UFO landing in my backyard. Y'all come get this thing.
And you're like, leave my UFO alone. we totally want to know, too. We absolutely want to know. If what you know about the UFO thing, we have inquiries coming in as we speak. We've got to take a quick break for the news. We're going to come back with our guest, Greg Allison. You're listening to We the People. You can find us at WeThePeopleRadio.us.
Doing bad things to you.